Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 17, 2005. Today's session is entitled Science and the Bible, Context, Text, and Meaning, Writings from the Time of the Jewish Exile. Presented by Levon Batalden. Let's listen in.
I'm Levon Batalden, and I'm a biologist, botanist, mycologist by training, and teach at a small liberal arts college in New Hampshire. And in addition to biology-related things, I've taught history of science and a course on science and religion. And it's out of that science and religion class that I came to appreciate that a major conflict that we find in our culture between science and religion is in how we read the Bible. And so I started to think about my interest in the history of science and how people viewed the world and nature at different times when the Bible was written. And today we're looking at the time of the Jewish exile, which is the 6th century BCE. But before we actually get to that time period, I'd like to look at the quotes for the day. And the one is the review of Krister Sandall's reminder that when you're doing historical inquiry, especially biblical studies, you need to ask what did the text mean and what does the text mean? That's a never-ending question, I think. And what we're doing this week is not going to be the forever answer to those questions. But it's the constant challenge, I think, of Christians looking at their sacred texts. And the other quote is from St. Augustine. So this challenge to understand what the scripture has to say is not new. No Christian would dare say that the words of the scripture are not to be taken figuratively. No one believes anything unless one first thought it believable. Everything that is believed after being preceded by thought. Not everyone who thinks believes, since many think in order not to believe, but everyone who believes thinks. Thinks in believing and believes in thinking. I just thought that was very telling. And so this idea that one needs to think about what one reads is not new in our tradition, but it's a very old part of our Christian tradition, and by people that we hold to be quite important in our tradition. We talked yesterday about the earlier times, the oral tradition, and then the early writing down of scriptures. And today we're looking at 600 BCE, as I said earlier. And this is a really exciting time in history. This is the era of Confucius. It's the era of Buddha. It's the time of Zoroaster. It's the time of Pythagoras and the pre-Socratic Greeks. It's when Aesop's fables were written, which is, you know, pretty important. And then the Jewish prophets, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, come from that period of time. So there, you wonder what it was that was going on in the world that had this sort of blossoming of thought in both the scientific world, early Greek scientists, and also in the religious era. So it's a fairly exciting time in history. But the part of the world that we're interested in looking at this evening is the world of Babylon. Can any of you tell me a king of Babylon?
Nebuchadnezzar.
And the Nebuchadnezzar we're familiar with is Nebuchadnezzar III. Wasn't the only Nebuchadnezzar. But in some things I was reading, it isn't only we who can name Nebuchadnezzar, but that's one of the few kings of Babylon that many people can name because he's written in the Bible. So if you know something about biblical tradition, you know the name Nebuchadnezzar. So we know him because of him being written about in the Bible. But he also was a fairly important king in Babylon as well, at a peak in Babylonian history and wealth and power. And if you think about the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, that's Nebuchadnezzar's creation, or he had his slaves creating it, probably not Nebuchadnezzar himself. and built many temples. The big Ziggurat of Babylon was built at that time, and a lot of gold and silver and precious metals, precious stones and semi-precious stones that decorated these temples. So it was a period of wealth. The language of Babylon was Aramaic, which is the language of the New Testament. It was the lingua franca at the time. The Babylonians were great astronomers. They had figured out the movements of Venus, a lot about the phases of the moon and eclipses of the moon, eclipses of the sun. They had long records of motions of the heavens. So they were very, they knew a lot of astronomy, and they had kept a lot of records. And the Greek philosopher Thales lived about 600 BCE, and he's often credited with figuring out eclipses of the sun and being able to predict when they would be, and supposedly allowed the Greeks to defeat the Medes because of his ability to predict that. But actually the Babylonians had pretty good capacity to predict eclipses of the sun and the moon before the time of Thales. Out of that astronomy comes astrology, and so that the movements of the stars and the planets and the moon were used to predict whether it was a good time to do this, that, or the other thing, particularly for the king. Ordinary people didn't usually have that capacity to go get their predictions done, at least at earlier, at this time in history. They were also great at divination, using animals to predict what was going to happen. And one of the things that they did is in predicting or diagnosing people's ills, they would have the person who was ill breathe into the nostrils of a sheep, and then after a certain period of time, they would sacrifice the sheep and take out the liver and look at what the liver looked like. And there are still models that remain from that time of different kinds of livers and what that meant if your liver looked like that. Because the liver was the seat of all essential life processes. So the liver was the most important, more important than the heart, the brain. It actually took quite a while before people thought the brain was important. But the liver was very important. And sometimes you would say that, you know, this sheep was, you know, a certain ancestor because your ancestors were fairly important, and they would then sacrifice that sheep and take out the liver and see, what does this liver look like? Is your ancestor approving of what you're going to do next, or is the ancestor not happy at all? So livers were quite important. They're also good at, they're good mathematicians, probably some of the best early mathematicians. And they, we have base 10 numbers, which are quite easy to work with. They had base 60. And then they had place value. So everything in the first column was up to 60, and then beyond that, they had two columns. So that they could do math fairly easily with that kind of base 60. Can you think of some place where we still use base 60?
Clock,
yeah. We still use the 60-minute hour and the 60-second clock. And so we use it in our time still from the Babylonians. Can you think of anything else where we have multiple 60?
Latitude
and longitude, yep, yep. Any kind of, we have 360 degrees in our circles, and we still use that kind of measurement still today. So our mathematics is, in some parts of it, are still based on Babylonian systems. They had no zero. Zero was a late understanding. It seems hard to think of not having a zero in your mathematical system, but they did not. They also made contributions to the calendar. Both the Sumerians and the Egyptians that we talked about yesterday were very interested in calendars, trying to predict when to plant and when, if I gave you a loan, you have to pay me back, and legal arrangements. But the Babylonians came up with a seven-day calendar. You had the sun god, the moon god, and the five planet gods. You had Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Those were the only planets that they could see. And so that gave you 7 days. You had to have a day for each god. That gave you seven. And couldn't have any more days in the week because there weren't any more heavenly gods. So that was the end of the number of days. And they also gave us the lunar calendar of 4 weeks in a month. And that had to do with the four phases of the moon. So that gave you 4 7-day weeks, which we still use. So, but there was an article, maybe it was in the New York Times a couple weeks ago, about the seven-day calendar. And they actually gave the Jews the credit for the seven-day calendar, but I think the Jews got it from the Babylonians. But it really has no rational basis. Seven isn't a multiple of the number of days that it takes the sun to rotate or anything of that sort. It's just it's because there were seven gods in the heavens and you needed 7 days. And I think Russia tried to move to a five-day week during the communist era, and people didn't like it. So even though I guess that works out better.
Levon?
Yes?
How did they see the stars? Did they have anything other than their eye?
No.
Look at the stars?
Mm-hmm. They didn't really have anything to look at the sky until Galileo really had a telescope. So this is all done with the naked eye. Amazing observation and patience to watch these things regularly to be able to predict things.
Did the Roman calendar really supersede the Babylonian?
No, it's later. It's later. Mm-hmm. other questions or comments about that kind of quick and dirty look at Babylonian science? in this period of time, is when the Hebrew people were taken into exile by the Babylonians. Nebuchadnezzar was, and the Babylonians were pretty powerful at that time, and they were not only, they did not only take Hebrews captive, but there were other tribal groups and peoples who were also taken into captivity. But they were not slaves. They were not taken as slaves. And not all the Israelites went. They took sort of the leaders and the more important people first. And but a number were left behind in Israel, but with, or in Palestine, but they did not have their leaders to the same degree. And they were, when the Babylonians took people into exile, they kept them in their own ethnic groups so that they were able to keep their identity even when they were out of their own land. And that probably allowed the Hebrew people to keep their identity in a way that they might not have had they not been treated as well. They also, if you, Daniel actually tells quite a little about what how the people were treated in exile. And that was written later, like the 3rd century BCE, but it describes the time in the 6th century BCE when people were in exile. And it talks about the people being fed at the king's table, which means they didn't come and eat with the king, but they were given rations by the king, so they were well fed. And there, a few of the people were also were taken in to be trained in Babylonian wisdom. And Daniel was one of those folks that was taken to be trained in Babylonian wisdom. So they were looking for smart people that they could train to help them have a good empire. So they weren't, they didn't just do what we consider slavish kind of jobs. And part of this training of Babylonian wisdom was to learn the Epic of Creation that we talked a little bit about yesterday. They learned about Gilgamesh, They learned about the origin of kingship, the way that sort of the divine development of kings. They were taught Babylonian fables. One of those fables was that the god Marduk muzzled the mouth of a lion and saved a holy man, which sounds a little like Daniel's story. So that was a fable up there of the Babylonians. A lot about omens, the being able to predict what the devils and the evil spirits were going to do. But the Babylonian devils and evil spirits were not on the level of gods. They weren't bad gods. They were between humans and gods, and they could cause trouble. But they were not as powerful as gods. So if the gods were on your side, you could take care of these evil spirits that were around you. They also were very interested in understanding dreams. So they trained, part of Babylonian wisdom was to how you interpret dreams. And dreams are important in Daniel, not just Daniel, in many places. Their prayers, astronomic observations that we talked a little bit about. The Code of Hammurabi was part of that training. And also there were apocalyptic works, sort of predicting end times, that were part of Babylonian understanding of the world. And you certainly see that in Daniel as well. So questions about, a little bit about what happened to the Israelites.
Laban, were there like technological differences in terms of like their capacity to make tools or those kinds of things? Because I have the image of, at a certain point, the Israelite people being pretty primitive in their tool using and them getting that kind of technology from other empires mm-hmm. that were farther along.
Mm-hmm. And Babylon was very advanced, yeah. I think much more so than the Canaanite tribes that were there. Hmm. Because they've been a more nomadic people.
Yeah.
So let's take a little look here at this is just that chronology of the Old Testament that we looked at a couple days ago. And highlighted in green are times of the setting of the books of the 6th century BCE. I guess we forgot to green up a little bit of Kings and Chronicles over here, so there's a little bit there. But then if you look at when things were written, there's a lot of writing that went on during exile. So that a lot of the of what we have in the Hebrew scripture comes from this period of time. So it was a time of a lot of creative and thoughtful things that were going on, and as we said earlier, not just in the Hebrews. But here we have a people who are in exile. They're in a culture that is different from theirs. Their numbers are much smaller because it wasn't all of Judah that came into exile. And so there was this need to identify themselves as God's people set apart, even though they're in the midst of this big city of Babylon. So they're looking back and wanting to record their history, and they're wanting to develop laws that are going to keep their people separate from the Babylonians. This is the time, I believe, when synagogues became important because they didn't have the temple anymore in which to worship. So that part of Judaism became more important. There was ritual purity before, certainly, but that became more clearly important to be ritually pure. So a lot of the purity rules and patterns come from this period. And it was important not to intermarry. You didn't want to dilute your Hebrew culture. And part of the concern in doing that is that you lose your gods. There's a passage in Deuteronomy 7, 3 to 4. Do not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, For that would turn away your children from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. So you didn't want to intermarry and take on foreign gods. And it's also, the writings that are done this time are considered the P tradition or the priestly writings. So that when you hear P tradition, you're talking about things that were written at this time. So that's a little look at the chronology there. Do you think we can turn that? I don't know. Yeah, so we should just observing, like looking at some of the major prophets, Isaiah and Obadiah, Zephaniah. Those are things that both happened and were written at the same time.
Yes.
What do you think brought about those particular...
Why they were written down so
soon? Right away. How were they recognized as something worth writing and saved right at the same time?
That's a very good question. I don't know why. I think in part they were just better able to write things down. They just had greater capacity to write things down, but... that
it also has to do with being in exile and that sort of sense of desperate, that they could perhaps hear the prophets among them
in a different way.
In a different way. They're more salient.
But there is much more of that writing down when it happened as opposed to later. And I think this general sense of recording who we are. Because it was important not just, I think, to the Hebrew people themselves, but this sense that they were to be a blessing to a much greater group, part of the world than just themselves as well, that may become stronger during that period of time. Other questions or comments about just the general writings of that? There are a couple things that aren't on your sheet there that I thought might be good to look at as a little setting for this time. Lamentations 5. If you'd like to look up Lamentations 5, and if somebody would.
Five what?
That's a good question. It's not very long there, Bob. I think we should read the whole thing.
Remember, Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see how we are scorned. The land we possessed is turned over to strangers, our homes to foreigners. We are like orphans without a father. Our mothers are like widows. We have to buy water to drink, water which is ours. Our own wood can be had only for payment. The yoke is on our necks. We are harassed. We are weary, but allowed no rest. We come to terms now with Egypt, now with Assyria, to provide us with food. Our forefathers sinned. Now they are no more, and we must bear the burden of their guilt. Slaves have become our rulers, and there is no one to free us from their power. We must bring in our food from the wilderness at the risk of our lives in the scorching heat. Our skins are blackened as in a furnace by the ravages of starvation. Women were raped in Zion, virgins ravished in the towns of Judah. Princes were hung up by their hands, elders received no respect. Young men toil, grinding at the mill, boys stagger under loads of wood. Old men have left off their sessions at the city gate. Young men no longer pluck the strings. Joy has vanished from our hearts. Our dancing is turned to mourning. The garlands have fallen from our heads. Woe to us, sinners that we are. This is why we are sick at heart. All this is why our eyes grow dim. Mount Zion is desolate and overrun with jackals. Lord, your reign is forever. Your throne endures from age to age. Why do you forget us so completely and forsake us these many days? Lord, turn us back to you and we shall come back. Renew our days as in times long past. But you have utterly rejected us. Your anger against us has been great indeed.
So this is the lament of the people who are left behind. It isn't so great to be under the dominion of the Babylonians. So we've got, that's the lament of people who are left behind. And that the slaves are ruling over them. These are people who used to be in the lower echelons of society, and now they're have power over the Israelites, and they have to pay taxes and things that are theirs. And so being left behind isn't so great either. Then let's look at Psalm 137. Would somebody like to read Psalm 137?
By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and there we wept. When we remembered Zion, on the willows there we hung up our hearts. There our captors asked for songs, and our tormentors asked for mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem's fall, how they said, tear it down, down to its foundations. O daughter Babylon, you devastator, happy shall they be who pay you back what you have done to us. Happy shall they be who take your little ones and dash them against the rock.
So here's the lament of the people who are in exile. They don't sound so happy. But here are people who have been promised the land, and they no longer have the land. And so they're, how can they worship God in a foreign place? And it's said that at this time, Jews became the people of the book rather than the people of the land. And so writing all of this down was extremely important. The readings that we have there, the next section, are basically have to do with the Babylonian love of numbers. And if you look at the things that were written during this particular time, there's a lot of measurements, a lot of numbers, important to make connections and be organized and very clear. And another thing that happened during that period of time is the different traditions were put together into a consistent book. And if you look at Genesis 6 to 8, two chapters there, and it's really the story of the flood. And it isn't that we need to read every bit of that story. It's a familiar story. But if you kind of look through, you'll see, I think, some fairly interesting... if you try and just read it as a continuous story, it doesn't make so much sense. We're so familiar with the story that I think we know what happened. But when you try and read it as a consecutive nice little story, the timing and everything is very strange. And and what scholars have decided is that this is really two stories that were put together, and they didn't want to give up either one of these traditions, so they kind of carefully interspersed them. And in the J tradition, you use Yahweh or Lord. The P tradition uses God or Elohim. And in the J tradition, the flood comes after a heavy rainfall. And in the priestly tradition, the flood's brought on by a disintegration of the orders established at creation. So the water comes up from the deep and floods the land. Chaos comes. And that idea of chaos, things falling apart, is very Babylonian. You're just barely keeping chaos away. To a much greater degree than in the Hebrew tradition. In the J tradition, it lasts 40 days and 40 nights, which, you know, who hasn't said the flood lasted 40 days and 40 nights? The P tradition actually says it lasts one whole year. And that fits in much more with the Babylonian timetable of 365 days of the year. In the J tradition, there are seven pairs of clean animals, two pairs of unclean animals. One pair of unclean animals, Because in this tradition, you needed to have the animals for food, and you needed to have them for sacrifice when you got off the ark. But in the pea tradition, you didn't eat any meat till after the flood. So you only needed one pair of each kind of animal because you weren't going to eat them. So if you look through at any of these particular passages, you'll see that they're very much interspersed. But it talks about 40 days and 40 nights, and then it talks about a year, and the numbers of animals are different. So
so should we try to do some of that?
I don't think we probably need to really do so much of that. It's just if you want to have a little idea of how that worked. So it was a coming together of the different traditions to make one whole story. Then, you know, sometimes when you make out handouts, you have typographical errors. So B and C of those next references are really duplicate. But let's look up 1 Kings 5:13 to 6:6. About in this part?
The verse?
It's verse 1 Kings 5:13 to 6:6.
It's Solomon's temple.
It's Solomon's temple, right. And you notice there are a few numbers thrown in here. Make things very precise. Tells you that there were 30,000 men and 10,000 a month in shifts, and they're a month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. And Solomon also had 70,000 laborers and 80,000 stone cutters, plus 3,300 supervisors. Whew, it was well supervised.
Sounds like a government job.
I think it was definitely a government job here. And then in that next section, it gives all the dimensions of the temple. How many cubits by wide, and the vestibule, how big it was, and a definite reflection of the importance of numbers in Babylonia, that you you have things very clearly organized and written out. And you have to wonder, do they have any clue how many people worked on Solomon's temple? But it's very clearly recorded here. Then in Genesis 9.
Here's a bond.
Yes.
When they came back after the exile and had an opportunity to rebuild, do you know if they used these?
I think there was an attempt to use those same directions, to rebuild it the same as it was. But whether or not it was, probably
right, exactly. It'd be very interesting if what they thought they were recreating was in fact a creation of out of their experience in exile, rather than the historical evidence.
Does anybody know whether the second rebuilt temple was supposedly the same?
Was what?
Whether the rebuilt temple? When they came back from exile to rebuild the temple, whether it was the same? It was the same?
I think so.
Okay. So it was
Or maybe what they recorded was what they built the second time.
Yeah.
Going back to the flood, what can we derive spiritually from that? Because it couldn't have happened.
Well, there are...
I mean, there are remnants of the... Yes, there was severe flooding of that era. We know that. But everybody didn't die.
No.
And they didn't have all the animals in the world.
No. No. What do you think is the spiritual meaning of the story of flood?
It was a warning to the people to shape up.
Okay. That if you don't follow the true God, bad things are going to happen. Not just to you, but the whole earth. It may well tie back to that responsibility for the earth as well. It isn't just yourself that you're protecting, but it's here, it's the whole earth as well.
And also providence for the faithful.
Mm-hmm. So that you are protected if you're faithful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little scary to think about even being the one that got to be on the ark as well, with all those animals and all the smell. 40 days and 40 nights sounds bad enough, but a year's worse.
Bring a sacrifice on the
boat. Yeah. On a wooden boat. Yeah. And I think the description of the ark itself is, you know, it's kind of a square blocky thing. It seems anything that sounds too quotable. But that's a very good question. Yeah. So what's the purpose? There have been some interesting, I don't know if you call them archaeological discoveries recently, that they think there was a time when there was a breaking away of a land mass in the area of the Dardanelles that actually would have caused a huge deluge, not from rain, but from the sea, that probably flooded a large area of that world, of the world. So that it's may have been something experienced, but then meaning was put on it, that this is God's punishment for those of us who are not faithful.
It was also an opportunity to tell a story about God's making specific promises of care to this people at the end of the story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it may have been a story about, like the creation story, is a sort of story of where did we come from.
Mm-hmm.
If we think we have a special relationship with God, yeah. Well, here's a story that helps explain that.
That's a very good point, yeah. And there's also this promise that there's never going to be that big a bad flood again. So there's a hope in that story as well.
Plus the children asking a question, why are there rainbows in the sky?
Yeah, why are there rainbows in the sky? Yeah. Because there probably were rainbows before the flood. any other comments about the flood questions? Appreciate you making your comments. Genesis 9:28 to 10:32. We are not going to read this, but this is another very important priestly addition, this importance of your ancestors and the connection from what was before and what's how you got to be who you are. We are people who can trace ourselves back to the beginning. We're not, and we're going to be continuing on. Important to see that so that these genealogies that you find throughout are important reminders of who you are. And the importance of ancestors, it certainly was true in Babylonia, but I don't think it's only that. It's more to describe that we're an important people. So those are just a few things to look at the influence of numbers in scriptural text. The next thing I'd like you to look at is the first creation story, in Genesis 1-2:4. Yesterday we looked at the second creation story, this agrarian story, starting out with man as the first thing created, or humans the first thing created, and then the animals and the plants and all come forth from that. And very little talk about heavens and earth. The heavens and earth just were there, but it was the people that were important. But in Genesis 1, we have a very different story that is, I think, just a beautiful, beautiful chapter. I love this Genesis 1. And it's something that's very familiar to us. So I'd like you to just take a few moments and read it, and then talk about what you see in the story. Two, three people working together.
All right.
This one's actually a lot of my old ones.
Sun god, the moon god, the planet gods, but this is our god at work in a 7-day week. Our god gave us 7 days, not about any of these other gods. So he's got 7 days.
Mm-hmm. Very astrological too. I mean, from the very beginning, it's the coming of this moon and the sun. Even though it's not said expressly, moon and sun, but you have this evening and day, and then the next day. So mm-hmm. that's an astrological explanation of day,
mm-hmm.
which is also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting they talk about the coming of the evening and the day, but it's not until the third day that there's the sun and moon.
That's right.
You
right.
got things,
but no sun and moon. Mm-hmm.
Would that be considered a demoting of the planets? and so forth, and the power of the story.
That's a great point.
Compete with the power had of the Babylonians.
And that's a very good point. But there might be well something to do that. That's not the sun and moon god that are making these things right. happen.
God called it light.
God called it light. There's God's light, not just sun and moon. Mm-hmm. I've never thought of that before. That's a very, I think that might be very important, demoting of gods. Anything else you noticed?
Well, in this translation, then God said, let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness. Us and our.
Good point. I mean, they're in this polytheistic culture, so maybe it just sneaks in there. I don't know.
It says it's the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough. Because in the beginning was the Word.
Word and that's Jesus. The Spirit.
Yeah, but who developed that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because there's no talk of the Trinity at that point when this was written.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much the experience they had of courts and the attendance of a king might have affected their sense of how many attendants God would need and these sort of creatures they imagined were surrounding God.
So it could be one God, but you've got to have a lot of...
Yeah.
If kings have a whole...
If it's real God, it has to have attendants and people waving fans and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You have that court in Job where God is in discussion with the beings of heaven.
Yeah.
And Satan's one of them.
But you notice that he's creating humankind in his image, and male and female he created them. It isn't just first males and then females come later. This is much more egalitarian creation that's going on in this story. So. And then you have the seventh day, where you have Sabbath. And now not only, so you have a Sabbath that is not just because some other culture says you have a Sabbath, but God instituted the Sabbath. And so it marks you apart from your culture. You have this Sabbath. Other comments about the story? As a botanist, I have a little trouble with part of the story because on the day that he creates the dry land, the plants come forth and there's no sun yet.
But there's light.
There is light, yep. But there was an early understanding that plants weren't really living. They were just extrusions of the soil. So the fact that they were living comes a little later. So they were different from living things like animals. Another part of the story that environmentalists and all have trouble with is this: be fruitful and multiply and have dominion over the earth. I'd like to have you share these little insights that you have. Okay. We're running out of time.
I can do this just very quickly and clean up.
Mm-hmm.
This I learned a long, long time ago. At a conference with Frank Seilhammer, who was a professor of Old Testament theology and president of Hammer School of Theology before its merger with Trinity Seminary in Columbus. He did a little Bible study of Genesis 1:28. And if I can do that just very briefly with you. Genesis 1:28, God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and so on. To multiply, in Hebrew, is the word rabah, from the root rav, which means to grow or to increase. Is there any word that you know that sounds a little bit like that, that might sound slightly Jewish?
Rabbi.
What does a rabbi do?
He teaches.
How did he teach? How did he learn? How did he become a teacher? What did he have to do?
Study.
He had to study. And what does study do to you? It matures you so that you grow, so that you grow in body, mind, and spirit. So one of the things that suggested, that Frank Seilheimer suggests, that one of the ways that we might translate this passage would be fruitful. I have terrible handwriting. And mature. If this means to grow, in what fashion? To grow as a rabbi would grow, then we grow in maturity, in understanding, in purpose. And be fruitful is mile, which is M-I-L-A-Y, which is what you do with a bucket. When you fill a bucket, you fill the bucket and you fill it right to the top, almost to the overflowing spot, but it doesn't quite overflow. The bucket is there to do what? To water your plants with, to bring a blessing, to be a blessing to the earth. So in this sense, to be fruitful means to be like a full bucket, to be fruitful in the sense of giving blessing to the earth. To subdue, kavash, and I'm running out of whatever this thing is here, which is not any better. Kavash means to pummel, but it's a medical term, and you talked about some of the medical terms of the Sumerians and the Akkadians. Kavash was a medical term used to knead, as if you're kneading bread, but in terms of if you had a boil and you're trying to knead the pus out of the boil, that is kavash. So what you're doing is you are really prodding something gently. You're gently prodding something. Oh, that's not any help at all. Gently prodding something.
Okay.
Having dominion. The word is rada, and rada is a loan word from the Akkadian. And a radu is a person who works the irrigation ditches. And what do you do when you're working the irrigation ditches? What you're doing is letting in water so that it can come in to make your fields bloom and blossom. So your purpose is to open the dikes to provide water to nourish the fields. So the translation is not so much to have dominion, but rather to make it function. So you might say, God blessed them, God said to them, fill, in the sense of giving a blessing, and mature, be fruitful and mature, and then gently knead creation so that you make it function.
Isn't that a very interesting translation of the and it's not any different words, it's just translating them slightly differently in a way that might be much more helpful to us today than at the time of the exile. But you can imagine at the time of the exile to be fruitful and multiply when you're this little small exiled group. You don't want to die off. So to be fruitful and multiply in a very literal sense would be an important thing. But maybe for us to think about being fruitful and multiplying, being a blessing and being mature and thoughtful is a interesting current understanding. So, and the idea that dominion isn't do whatever you like, but it's very thoughtful, careful use of the resources we have. Other comments, questions? Our time is about up, I think, for the day. Okay.
Thank you very much for coming. Tomorrow we'll talk about the...